Today on Idea Tellers.
Bottom line is what I've discovered when I start to ask people what their pain points are, what are the issues they're confronting, what's the number one thing they think we should be doing, is a very revealing process.
Lisa Gable is a consultant and former ambassador of the United States to the World Expo and the author of Turnaround, How to Change Course When Things Go South.
I was willing to go out on a cormorant fishing boat that held three people in my high heels and my St. John suit and sit in the middle of a lake while fishermen were fishing. I think my willingness to do whatever they asked me to do, if I was dressed for it or not, was something that helped create a level of commonality and friendliness, and we all got a giggle out of it.
In this first part of our interview, she's going to show us the art of obtaining the necessary information to tackle the issues in our organizations. This is Idea Tellers. Hola, mi gente. Bienvenidos. Welcome to another edition of Idea Tellers. Today, I have the honor of having former ambassador to the UN and author of the book Turn Around, Lisa Gable. She has been recognized worldwide as a mastermind. She has been the CEO of several organizations, former presidential appointee. Furthermore, in 2004, Ambassador Gable was appointed the first woman in the World's Fair history to direct the U.S. Pavilion with a budget of $33 million. That's something that the U.S. had not always participated in. So it's a great honor to have you here. Bienvenida. Welcome, Ambassador Lisa Gable.
Well, thank you. It is such an honor to be with you today, and I do so appreciate your reaching out.
Thank you. Your book is called Turnaround. And to me, it's fascinating because the subtitle says, How to Change Course When Things Are Going South. And I've always thought that it's a matter of positive attitude, like that concept of jujitsu, of having that momentum turn it into something positive towards you. But that is easier said than done. How did you come with that idea, that concept of turnaround, if I may ask?
Well, I have to give full credit to my publisher. He actually contacted me through a PR agent with whom I worked in March of 2020. And he said, I think the turnarounds you've done in business, government, philanthropy, and what you learned and how you did those is going to be really pertinent for people when we come out of COVID. Now, at this point in time, we thought we'd be coming out of COVID faster than we did. But at the same time, what he recognized is that the principles that I applied to turn around, no matter what the sector was, were actually the same and did enable us to take an organization that was headed south and move it into an organization that was tracking to become one of the top leaders in its field.
And thank you for pointing that out. Now, obviously, that is a very demanding task that needs to be subdivided. And as I said, the concept of turning a crisis into opportunity, just like that famous saying about the kanji symbol for crisis, means both opportunity and danger. However, you went into the nitty-gritty of things, not at the romantic side. Then you break it into different chunks. One of those is seeing that crisis or when things are going tough for an organization, first we need to get rid of assumptions. Why and how, if I may ask, Ambassador Gable?
Sure. When anyone walks into a turnaround situation, particularly if it's an industry that they've been in for a long period of time, there is a tendency, it's a human tendency to make assumptions, right? You make assumptions about the people that you meet, you make assumptions about what they must have done wrong. And the reality is every turnaround I was brought into, I was the Hail Mary pass, which means that the organization had recruited and brought in people who fit a particular profile or characteristics based on their credentials. And they tried the same things over and over again. But there was something unique about each one of the situations that I walked into. And it was due to that uniqueness that it actually was stronger for an individual like me to come in from the outside and with no assumptions, right? I hadn't been in the industry. I had no assumptions about what was going wrong. I just knew something was. And to walk in with your mind empty and to be able to dig in, interview people, and identifying the underlying cause of the disease, that is empowering. The reality is, in my career, so many times, what people thought was wrong was actually not the thing that was wrong. It was my ability to figure out that there was actually this underlying cause, this underlying sickness that was causing the organization not to work very well, that enabled me to tackle that item while at the same time keeping the objectives and key results that those who hired me wanted to see accomplished.
Brilliant. Two questions based on that. First one, how were you able to identify the root cause? And number two, how were you able to implement the solutions that might have be against the culture that was permeated across the organization at that moment, if I may ask?
Sure. One way that I begin is that I develop an interview sheet and I go and I meet with people at their desks. I call it my shuttle diplomacy. I learned it at the State working at the United Nations. And I ask people the same questions. And what I'm trying to understand is their pain point. What is the thing that is causing them the greatest pain in doing their job? And by doing that, I will ask them what they assume is causing their pain, what they assume is keeping the organization from doing the thing that it needs to be able to do. I also ask people, what's the number one thing, if you had to just narrow everything down to this one thing you had to do in order to survive and thrive, what is it? And if we thought about the organization overall, if there was only one thing the organization could do, what would it be? And what is your role to that action? Through that process, I am able to understand at a very basic level where the hiccups are occurring, where things are going south. And I'm going to give you a very simple example that I gave recently but seemed to resonate. And it wasn't a big turnaround. This was a tiny turnaround.
Okay.
When I was at Intel Corporation, I was asked to run and build Intel's corporate identity brand program in order to prepare the company to execute what would be called the Intel Inside program, a place where Intel would be spending billions of dollars to go after a consumer market. And so we were standardizing all the various looks and feels and logos and other issues that affected what a brand would be. And we developed guidelines, physical printed guidelines. It was before the internet was something that it is today. It was before the web. And we would send these guidelines to other countries as Rev 1. We wanted their opinions. So we'd send it out to Europe. We'd send it to the Japanese. And we'd say, okay, this is what we're thinking about doing. We want you to physically see it and let us know your opinions. And the Europeans weren't playing ball. They weren't giving us their opinions. We weren't hearing from them. And they're acting a little, you know, perturbed every time we got them on the telephone. So my boss said, fly to Munich and sit down with them and understand what's going on. We walked in with assumptions. One of the assumptions was that the Europeans were more advanced than the United States as it was related to climate and environmentally friendly materials. So we thought, oh, we must have stepped over a line that had to do with paper quality or the size of paper. Perhaps we used too many Americanisms and too many American visual dynamics that weren't for European market. So I went over ready to fight the battles and make sure that they understood that we were listening to them. And I get over there and they kept asking me these questions. And again, they were all so perturbed. And finally, I brought out these documents that we'd sent them. And I go, I don't understand why you're acting this way. We sent you this document. And they're like, well, we've never seen those documents.
Oh.
And I said, what? They go, well, we mailed them to you. And I stopped the meeting and I ran downstairs to the Intel mail room in Munich, Germany. And I started opening cabinets. And in the cabinets were all of the boxes I had been sending to them for months. The reality was it had nothing to do with the Europeans' opinions about corporate identity, brand management, and environmental practices, which is what we all automatically assume the problem is. It had to do with the fact that they never got their mail. And they thought that the Americans didn't care enough about them, that we weren't actually including them in the give and take process. We weren't actually asking for their input because we were blowing them off. We were ghosting them, to use terminology 40 years later. So the reality is it was the mailroom. And we actually ended up fixing the mailroom and the problems that it had. Turned out that wasn't the only problem. We weren't the only ones suffering, but it did clear up a lot of the miscommunication between the Americans and the Germans.
I bet. Amazing how something so out of one's sight can affect so deeply the relationship within a global organization. Thank you for sharing that.
But bottom line is what I've discovered when I start to ask people what their pain points are, what are the issues they're confronting, what's the number one thing they think we should be doing, it truly is a very revealing process.
Yes. Getting to the human level there, getting people to open up, obviously, you've been good at that, at reaching at that level and obtaining the right information and answers. I'm going to assume that is a great part of what helped you in your diplomatic career. Would that be accurate, Ambassador?
100%. We do not do a good enough job in going out into the field and asking people what is wrong. Mm-hmm. And when I served as the U.S. Ambassador to the World Expo in Japan, I not only spent time with the people in charge of the World Expo, as well as the various countries that were presenting there, but I also went out and if I was invited to go to a remote village in Japan, I went. I was there to serve both a multilateral purpose, which was U.S. representation amongst 120 participating countries, but I also had to serve a strong bilateral purpose, which was U.S. relationship with Japan, who was a key ally, particularly with the rise of China. Mm-hmm. And spending time in acknowledging what they wanted to have heard by an American official and committing to incorporating their points of pain or their concerns into my messaging and what I would serve back to the White House as to what was of interest to the Japanese. People were so happy that I took the time to go talk to regular people. And in fact, the top executives from the government and within the palace on behalf of the Crown Prince, who's now the Emperor of Japan, they were so pleased that I took the time to really go out and listen to what the Japanese people thought about their relationship with America.
Wow. It's interesting because in many cultures, when they see a dignitary of your caliber, they don't see them as approachable at all. And you set out to break that mold.
Yes, best help that I was willing to go out on a cormorant fishing boat that held three people in my high heels and my St. John suit and sit in the middle of a lake while fishermen were fishing.
Oh, no. So, are you kidding me?
I think my willingness to do whatever they asked me to do, if I was dressed for it or not, was something that helped create a level of commonality and friendliness, and we all got a giggle out of it.
So in order to get to that point of people opening up, they see that you're walking the walk, am I right?
They do. And you've got to also be interested in people. I mean, nothing bothers anyone more than a politician walking up to them and giving the handshake and doing the normal big smile. And obviously then moving on to the next person. One thing that I have learned and I try to do is advance of meeting anyone, I do research who it is that I'm meeting, what the issues are that they've been facing. I ask people for background information on that individual, what they care the most about. And so when I walk into the meeting, not only am I saying, hi, I'm Lisa Gable, it's so nice to meet you. And then as we're conversing and having the conversation, I bring it around to the things that I have done my research and I know that they care about. Because truly in all conversations, you have to understand what's important to the person that you're talking to. That's all that matters. What's important to you does not matter. What's important to them, that's what matters.
Doing our homework before we're going to sit down at a table.
Absolutely. And there's no excuse. You have the internet.
That's right.
When I talk to young people and they go in for a job interview, I'm like, did you Google the person? Did you listen to any of their podcasts? Did you read any articles that they've been quoted in? There is absolutely no excuse in today's environment to not at least do a half an hour of research in advance of meeting someone, because we do go online and we do talk about what we care about. It's a matter of taking the time, looking through the different platforms, and trying to identify on a piece of paper, what does this person care about? What motivates them?
Empathy doesn't happen just like that. You need to put some effort into it, and you need to be intentional then and invest time. I'm fascinated by the Japanese culture. Something I did notice in my experience with the UN is that in any Japanese meeting, you really need to learn how to read between the lines and really know what is not being said verbally, but it's been said at the same time. Was that your experience? And if so, how were you able to navigate those challenges of communication, if I may ask?
You find back channels. In any diplomatic situation, in any business situation, you find back channels. And what back channels mean is that you begin developing relationships with people who are lower down on the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
And you develop a personal relationship with them. You ask them for inputs off the record. You promise and keep your promise that you will never identify that they were the one who informed you of something. And those become your go-to people that enable you to ask in advance of the meeting, what are they going to care the most about? What's going to bother them? Is there something that's happened recently that has made the situation uncomfortable? So again, this gets to the fact that I trust staff to give me briefings, and my staff does a great job, has through every job that I've had, in briefing me in advance about someone I'm going to meet. But I also like to do my own research.
Okay.
And because I do notice that I have a different perspective and I can look at something that someone said differently as a senior level individual, because I have more of an understanding as to what crisis they were in the middle of and why they may have reacted the way that they did. And I think that's harder for younger staff to truly conceptualize unless you've had to manage it yourself.
That is brilliant. An insight that I hadn't thought of.
Thank you, Ambassador Gable, for your time. Mi gente, this concludes the part one of our interview with Ambassador Lisa Gable. Please be in the lookout for part two, in which we will cover more about her trajectory and how we can apply her knowledge into our own careers. This is Idea Tellers.